morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January the 19th, and here's some of the stories that we're covering for you this morning. The UN Human Rights Office has condemned what it says is the brutal, disproportionate use of force by Sudan's security forces against peaceful protesters.
They are calling for the restoration of civilian rule, and they are calling for accountability. And every time there are additional killings, additional violence against peaceful protesters, it emboldens the protest movement, and there are further protests, further violence.
And the Rwandan government is warning citizens who are fleeing to neighboring countries, fearing vaccination, that they may risk losing access to basic services.
Those countries, also they are vaccinating, so you can't say, I'm going to Tanzania, I'm going to Burundi, I'm going to DRC. They are vaccinated. So there is no need to fear vaccines as long as the government has been trying to make sure that everyone is vaccinated.
That is Rwanda's Minister of Local Government, Jean-Marie Vianney Gatabazi. A new report by Kenyan civil society groups says that sexual violence is used as a political tool during elections in the country. We have these stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the UN Human Rights Office has condemned what it says is the brutal, disproportionate use of force by Sudan's security forces against peaceful protesters, many of whom reportedly are being killed and injured every day. The Suchline reports for VOA from Geneva.
The military mounted a coup d'etat against Sudan's civilian government on October 25th. Since then, credible statistics from the Central Committee of Sudan Doctors show state security forces have killed 71 people and injured more than 2,200. Of these, 17 have been killed this year. UN monitors report such atrocities occur on an almost daily basis. On Monday, they noted security forces used live ammunition to break up a demonstration in the capital, Khartoum, killing 7 protesters and injuring dozens. The use of live ammunition is only permissible as a measure of last resort under international law. UN Human Rights Spokeswoman Mervina Shamdasani says a thorough, independent investigation into these violations must take place promptly. She adds the authorities must bring the perpetrators of human rights violations to justice.
It is crucial that these investigations take place, and in fact, this is one of the calls of the protesters as well. They are calling for the restoration of civilian rule, and they are calling for accountability. And every time there are additional killings, additional violence against peaceful protesters, it emboldens the protest movement, and there are further protests, further violence.
She says this is clearly not the path to the restoration of sustainable, peaceful civilian rule in Sudan. Shamdasani tells VOA military authorities justify their actions by claiming they are trying to maintain public order. She says they claim protesters have used violence and that some of those who have been arrested and are responsible for the killing of an army official as well.
But our monitoring of the protests has shown that they are by and large very peaceful. The most force that we have seen used is protesters throwing stones. Nothing at the level of the live ammunition that's being used by the military in responding to the protesters.
Shamdasani notes the United Nations does not recognize the military leaders as the legitimate government of the country. However, as the de facto authorities in Sudan, they currently are in charge. She says this means they have human rights obligations toward the people of Sudan. She says they are responsible for investigating allegations of human rights violations, including killings and gender-based sexual violence. And she adds, the military leaders must hold the perpetrators of these crimes accountable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Somalia's worst drought in decades has millions of people dependent on food aid and thousands flocking to cities to escape hunger. At makeshift shelters on the outskirts of the capital, Mogadishu, displaced people face cramped conditions and poor sanitation in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mohamed Sheikh Nu reports from Mogadishu.
Somali villagers escaping drought are arriving every day in camps for internally displaced people on the outskirts of the capital, Mogadishu. At the Najah camp, 45-year-old mother of four, Muhubba Adam, is cooking what food she has for her family. They arrived last week after fleeing her village in Lower Shabelle, some 90 kilometers away. She says they had to leave because they had no rain for two seasons and the drought devastated livestock and farms. Adam says they spent a whole day trekking to get to the camp. But conditions in the crowded camp are also difficult. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, nobody is wearing a mask. There is no room to socially distance and sanitation is poor. 56-year-old Nur Hassan Ali looks much older than his age and appears weak as he slowly moves past the camp's makeshift tents. He and his family of six also fled hunger in their village last week, but are not doing much better near the city. Ali says his livestock began to die because of the long drought, so he had to run away with his children and finally reached the camp. But now, here he says they don't have anything and his children are hungry and don't have any food. Ali says that he's also sick. District authorities put Faiz Omar in charge of keeping track of new arrivals to the camp. She says the Najah camp is home to 370 families who have recently been displaced by drought and whose livestock was wiped out. Omar says they are not receiving any assistance either from the government or from aid agencies. She says they lack shelter from the sun, the cold, and the rain. But it is a lack of rain back home that forced the influx of villagers to Mogadishu. It is putting a strain on the city's health care system, which was struggling even before the pandemic, says Martino Hospital Director Dr. Abdirsaq Yusuf. He says the drought comes at a time when they are grappling with the burden of a recurrence of COVID-19. Yusuf says the drought has only added a further burden on the already existing COVID-19 problem, which has caused sickness and death. He says the drought is causing its own bane and plight as it also spreads disease. The government and UN aid agencies have warned that millions of people in Somalia are in urgent need of food assistance. Officials say thousands of refugees living in camps near Mogadishu are also vulnerable to diseases from poor sanitation, congestion, and dirty water. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
The Rwandan government is warning citizens who are fleeing to neighboring countries to avoid vaccination that they may risk losing access to basic services in the country. Authorities say that some Rwandans are fleeing to the neighboring countries of the DRC, Burundi, and Tanzania to escape vaccination campaigns that have been rolled out throughout the country. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali.
There's no exact number of Rwandans who have fled. Escaping COVID-19 vaccines, but the government of Rwanda has acknowledged that some who have fled have been brought back. Jean-Marie Vianney Gatabazi is the minister of local government.
In those countries, also they are vaccinating. Okay. So you can't say, I'm going to Tanzania, I'm going to Burundi, or I'm going to DRC. They are vaccinating. So there is no need to fear vaccines as long as the government has been trying to make sure that everyone is vaccinated. The issue of resisting to vaccination has been observed in different corners of the country because we are dealing with the mindsets of people. This is about behavior change.
Dr. Daniel Ngamije, the Rwandan Health Minister, says the rate of hesitancy to vaccinations will drop as authorities continue mobilization.
I think it's a matter of education, convincing, and they should themselves cross-check around and be aware of what we are saying. As I said, if you compare what happened at the time we were with very low vaccination rate in July, in January last year, a lot of people in hospitalized in very severe conditions, compared to what we are seeing today, it should inform people that there is, we have advantages of being vaccinated.
Nearly all public services are accessible only for vaccinated people. Public transportation, hotels and restaurants. Minister Jean-Marie Vianney Gatabazi says restrictions will continue.
Rights of people has limits because your right, my right. If I'm vaccinated, you are not vaccinated, you don't have right to come and to infect me. So they have to remember that we don't have to expose others who are vaccinated. We tell them to go for vaccination first, then go to benefit the services.
Rwandans who are hesitating to be vaccinated say they heard that COVID-19 vaccines cause other long-term health problems. He says, I didn't want to be vaccinated because I heard that when you take the jab, you no longer be able to produce children. You become infertile. And that was a risk I was not ready to take. Rwanda has the target of vaccinating 60% of its population by June this year. According to the Rwanda Biomedical Center, as of early January 2022, more than 40% of the population had been fully vaccinated, meeting the global target set by the WHO. Eugene Uimana, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Voice of America!
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The International Labour Organization warns that human trafficking is the fastest growing crime globally, and it is the third largest crime next to drugs and weapons smuggling. Human trafficking often ends up in involuntary servitude, slavery, and forced labor. Modern-day slavery, which is said to victimize over 40 million people, occurs in most regions and countries around the world. The practice contravenes the UN protocol to prevent, suppress, and punish trafficking in persons, especially women and children. But traffickers employ several coercive and deceptive practices to exploit and enslave their victims, often limiting their ability to speak out or to seek help. Joanna Iwa-James is the executive director of the anti-slavery organization Freedom United. In this first part of our two-part conversation, she tells me that modern-day slavery is all around us and can sometimes involve people making our clothes, working in factories, or even serving our food.
Most people hear about slavery and think it's a relic of the past. How does modern-day slavery manifest itself, and how does it differ from our understanding of slavery as we read in our history books?
There's a really big distinction between historical slavery and what we really call contemporary forms of slavery, because today there is no such thing as the ability to own another person as property, which is what historical slavery was. It is against the law in just about everywhere, and you cannot hold someone else as property. Nevertheless, it still happens that people are effectively treated in that way. So that means that they are exploited for somebody else's benefit. Could be for their labor or sexually exploited. But the key thing is that one person's used as another like they were their property. Mm. It's in today's form of what we call modern slavery or contemporary forms of slavery.
And what are some of the factors driving this system of modern day enslavement? What kind of power dynamics or economic drivers of this system?
That's a really interesting question, because in fact, we know that modern slavery is actually pretty endemic. And modern slavery is really a catch-all term to include forms of exploitation like human trafficking, forced labor, debt bondage, bonded labor, child slavery, domestic servitude. But altogether, we're looking at approximately, best estimate is that 40 million people at any one time are living in these sorts of conditions. So is it, and that number is probably very conservative. So it's at the systems that drive it are actually pretty far reaching. We know when we look at the risk factors, that there are definitely a higher number of people who are exploited, who are marginalized in society, who are discriminated against around the world. To pick one example, domestic servitude in the Middle East. We see migrant workers travel from other parts of the world, and Africa is certainly one region, but also Southeast Asia, go to work in a household and are actually enslaved in domestic servitude, where they're not allowed out of the house. They're working all the time for no pay, not fed properly, in really poor conditions, and not the conditions that they were promised when they left to go and take that work up.
And how do people often get end up in these circumstances? Are they lured? Is it about deception? Is it force? How do they get into these systems of enslavement?
Yeah, it's a good question. And deception is a really big part of it, especially for human trafficking. It's actually one of the criteria that we look at. So it's the act of deceiving someone, and then the way that they're moved from one place to another for the purpose of exploitation. So they may be promised an opportunity for a job, and when they get there, the terms and conditions are not as they see it. And that's a very soft way of putting it, because it's not just that the terms and conditions are not as they were promised. It might be entirely different. So, you know, we know of stories of people who have taken up jobs to go and work, say, for example, in a restaurant, but then find themselves actually forced into a situation of sexual exploitation or domestic servitude. So for sure, a big part of it is deception. Taking advantage of and willingness to take risk to look for better opportunities, often overseas, but it doesn't have to be, can be within the same country. I think that we often think of human trafficking as being across borders. It may be, but it isn't the only way in which people are exploited. Going back again to the question of discrimination.
That is Joanna Iwa-James. She is the executive director at Freedom United, an anti-slavery organization. I reached her in Kigali, Rwanda. And still in East Africa, sexual violence is used as a political tool during elections in Kenya. And this is according to the report released by the civil societies who are calling on the Kenyan government to take actions needed ahead of the 2022 polls. The report shows patterns of sexual violence during the past three general elections in Kenya and its consequences on survivors. Maureen Ojambo reports from Milwaukee.
The joint report is based on two fact-finding missions following the 2017 elections and conducted in July and December 2018 in the counties of Migori, Kisumu and Vihiga. This section analyzes the circumstances in which sexual and gender-based violence was perpetrated in the year 2007, 2013 and 2017 election periods. The Executive Director, Kenya Human Rights Commission, Davis Malombe, said that most of the rape acts were carried out by the police officers.
There were serious acts of rape and other forms of violence against women. Of course, there was a gang rape, and there was also most of the people who were targeted were poor people within those regions. The alleged perpetrators are also police officers.
The report shows that in each election, there has been gender aspect to political violence and discrimination, with women being the target. Mr. Malombe says most sexual offences during the political violence are never documented.
When there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of manifestation of SGBV, which in most cases is used as a tool of suppression. And in most cases, actually, we don't end up documenting SGBV the way it is supposed to, and also respond to it the way it is supposed to in the context of election.
In the cases documented by Human Rights Watch, survivors were raped by more than one perpetrator, and in some cases by more than 10. Program advisor at the Kenya Human Rights Commission, Irene Soila, said that in most cases, the Kenyan authority failed to address the matter.
Despite concordant elements documented by multiple stakeholders, Kenyan authorities continue to fail to implement survivors' rights to justice and reparation. From the history of 2007 to date in 2017, our report has shown or has tried to highlight the non-commitments to address issues of violence by the authorities in charge. So it is key that we realize that there is need for authorities to take action when this happens. Most of the survivors were raped without protection.
Kenya's Electoral Commission Vice Chairperson Juliana Cherera says the committee has been formed to empower women and to end sexual violence during elections.
So this Women Coordinating Committee, it is a voice amongst women so that women, we can speak amongst each other. We don't have to be raped for someone to get elected. So we are looking at women having a voice that they can say no. And we, as the women of Kenya, we are saying no to this.
According to the information collected by the Commission of Inquiry on Post-Election Violence, victims of sexual violence were predominantly women from economically poor backgrounds who lived in the slums of Nairobi and in rural areas across the country. The report also revealed that some men, in particular men from the Luo ethnic group, were subjected to sexual violence mainly in the form of forced circumcision or genital mutilation carried out in a crude manner with objects such as broken glass. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is unveiling a massive pyramid of rice harvested by farmers to pay back bank loans they borrowed to expand their production. Nigerian officials said the low-interest loans helped more than double the average yield of rice and maize, ending the country's dependence on rice imports. The Central Bank of Nigeria plans to sell the rice at below market rates to reduce the high prices that consumers have been paying for the staples. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The massive pyramid of rice bags stacked one on top of the other was unveiled Tuesday at the charter office of the Nigerian Chamber of Commerce in Abuja. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari presided over the ceremony with top government officials, including from the Central Bank and various state governors, in attendance. President Buhari praised the farmers and urged more of them to participate in the loan program.
It is my desired hope and expectation that other agricultural commodity associations that are yet to participate under the Anchor Borrowers Program will emulate the Rice Farmers Association of Nigeria in supporting our administration's drive for food self-sufficiency.
The Anchor Borrowers Program was launched in 2015 by Nigeria's Central Bank. The plan provides rice farmers with loans and technical advice so they can expand production and increase yields while limiting the nation's dependence on imports. Authorities say more than 5 years later, the program has yielded the desired result, reducing rice imports significantly and boosting local production from about 4.5 tons a year to 9. Central Bank Governor Godwin Emefiele says the resilience of farmers has paid off.
Permit me to commend our Nigerian smallholder farmers once again and the leadership of the various commodity associations for their diligence, for their bravery, patriotism and adaptability. The past few years, Your Excellency, have been quite challenging for these people as they have battled with insurgency, banditry, lockdown and other related setbacks. Indeed, we lost some of our farmers to insurgency attacks nationwide, whilst some could not access their farms for several months.
Nigeria banned rice imports in 2015 with the aim of producing the staple locally. At Tuesday's launch, authorities expressed confidence that adequate quantities of rice could be produced locally, saying the trend could affect the domestic price of rice. Meanwhile, the Rice Farmers Association urged Nigeria to leverage this opportunity and export the commodity to other West African nations. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, remember to visit our website at voanews.com. You can connect with us on all social media platforms on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day ahead, Africa.